You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+. The U.S. sends more missiles to Ukraine. Millions in Shanghai get back to work. And Canada cracks down on handguns. The biggest stories from around the world today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to temporarily block a Texas law that would have taken effect this week. The law would have limited large social media companies' ability to moderate content on their platforms. Supporters of the law have argued that those companies are silencing conservative viewpoints. The case again brings up the question of how the First Amendment should be applied to speech on the internet. Our guest says the laws in Texas and elsewhere get things wrong, but he says social media companies are making bad arguments too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much ability should social media platforms have to limit what appears on their platforms? Where should the line be drawn? Who should draw it? How much should the government step in to regulate it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wilkins is a senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, where he focuses on freedom of speech online and government regulation of social media platforms. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to join you.
Now, off the top, Scott, you were a lead counsel on an amicus brief that the Knight First Amendment Institute submitted in the Texas case. You have concerns about the Texas law and some others. What worries you about the way, say, Texas approached this issue?
Texas really has taken an extreme position that the First Amendment doesn't apply to social media platforms, that companies like Twitter and Facebook, they have no First Amendment rights when they offer their platforms to users. And in essence, that the state, that Texas, that state governments, and maybe even the federal government can wield enormous power over speech on these platforms.
So what exactly would this Texas law do if it ultimately gets approved in the court system?
It does really two things, and we view the two things a bit differently. The first is that it would prohibit the platforms from taking down content that the platforms don't want to publish. This provision basically says you can't take down any content because of its viewpoint. The law doesn't define viewpoint, but you know, I think as understood by most reasonable people, it means that the social media platforms would have to host a lot of content that they find objectionable, that they currently take down. The second thing that the law would do is it would require the platforms to disclose a range of important information to users and the public, commercial information of various kinds, some of it that has to do with their content moderation. And we think that the first thing I mentioned, this requirement to host content that you don't want to publish, that is very problematic. The second thing, the disclosure requirements, are a more difficult question under the First Amendment. And you know, we think that some disclosure requirements would likely pass a First Amendment test.
A lot of the motivation here seems to be concerns that some platforms, like Twitter, for example, treat conservatives unfairly, including blocking former President Trump after the January 6th insurrection. Some studies have suggested it isn't so much that conservatives are targeted, but that they run afoul sometimes of misinformation policies. How much is this partisan concern driving these kind of laws?
Well, the government in Texas, I mean, certainly the governor and various other officials in Texas made it very clear that that this law, HB 20, was motivated by the idea that these platforms silence or are biased against conservative voices. There's no secret about that. But beyond that, it's really hard to know, what was in legislators' minds or anything. It's just statements that were made by the governor and others in the state government.
Now, you've also written critically about some of the arguments coming from social media companies or organizations representing them and how they characterize their role and their relationship to the First Amendment. What do you see wrong on that side?
Yeah, so, a moment ago I said Texas, basically says that these social media companies have no First Amendment rights. And the social media companies kind of are on the opposite end of the spectrum. They say they have enormous First Amendment rights that, and that basically any government regulation that implicates, that touches on their First Amendment rights is unconstitutional. So basically the government really can't do anything to regulate the social media platforms. And that we just think that's, you know, plainly wrong, just like the Texas position is wrong. And, you know, what we think is really important here is to understand that the government can have a constructive, a positive role in regulating these platforms to ensure that the platforms serve our democracy, serve public discourse. And one of the ways that the government can do that is by requiring the platforms to disclose how they treat user content, how they moderate content, what their policies are. There are various ways that the government could require platforms to be more transparent, and that transparency could really serve the public.
And one of the tricky things here is kind of dueling metaphors about what a social media platform is. The argument, I think, from social media companies is, we're like a newspaper. So freedom of the press protections are there. We have a right to say what content does and doesn't appear on the stuff we own. The Texas law, and I think others say, no, you're more like a, you know, you're like the phone company. You don't get to decide who gets to call who and say what to whom. If I understand some of what I've read by you correctly, it's kind of a little of both and a little of neither.
Well, yes, I mean, in the sense that certainly when it comes to the newspaper analogy, I mean, we agree that there are some similarities. You have to really look at the specific activity you're talking about, and does that really look like something that similar to what newspapers do editorially? So we see some similarities there and some differences, and I'll come back to that. We don't really, I mean, it seems to us like the common carrier issue, the sort of, are you like, you know, the Telegraph or something, that's kind of in some ways an all or nothing question. So it's hard to be a little bit, you know, like the Telegraph. But on the First Amendment question and the newspapers, there are some similarities, and the two ones that we point to that are important here are the ability to decide what you will and won't publish, what content you'll put up and what content you won't. And that seems very much like what a newspaper editorial room does when it decides what will appear in the newspaper and what won't appear. The other thing that seems quite similar to us is when a platform decides to label content, to actually speak itself about what's on the platform, that just seems to be a little bit like when a newspaper publishes an editorial.
We're talking to Scott Wilkins from the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, looking at social media and the First Amendment after the U.S. Supreme Court this week blocked, for now, a Texas law from going into effect. It would have stopped large social media companies from moderating certain kinds of speech on their platforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you want social media companies to control what appears from users on their sites? Should they be able to restrict misinformation? Should they not be able to? Should the federal government do more to regulate? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Scott Wilkins, senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, looking at the ways that Texas and Florida are trying to regulate large social media companies and platforms in their states. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a Texas law from coming into effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your opinions, and maybe your experiences encountering content moderation that blocked you or didn't block somebody you think ought to have been blocked. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rochelle is with us in Minneapolis. Rochelle, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm in the car, so hopefully I am not breaking up.
Loud and clear.
Awesome, thank you so much. I work in the legal cannabis industry as a writer and journalist, and this is an issue that we face quite frequently in this space, and to a lesser extent, tobacco. So it's definitely not just political speech that's being targeted. cannabis accounts are being flagged and deleted constantly with no chance to review. And what our understanding of it is mostly that social media companies are deploying to find content that they deem unacceptable or goes against their rules. And so I was hoping that you could speak a little bit to the technology to let people know how this content is being moderated.
Rochelle, thanks for the call. A complicated question, Scott. I imagine it's different from one platform to another, but in a case like this, a legal industry in some places, an illegal industry in others, how might that interact with moderation systems?
Sure. I will address that to the extent that I can.
Sure.
I'm not a technologist here, but the companies use a variety of methods, which they do disclose to some degree on their websites, whether they're automated methods like algorithms, whether they're other users flagging what other users do. And sometimes, it's actually just employees at the company that are assigned to review various kinds of content. So there's a real mixture of ways. But, one of the things that's really important from our perspective, in terms of the kind of disclosure and transparency of the platforms, is that there be some way for users to be notified when their content is taken down or some other adverse action is taken against their content, and also that users have a right to appeal. Those are at least important considerations. They are different from the government telling platforms what they must and must not host. But providing that kind of due process can be very important to protect the speech of users.
Rochelle, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, let's go back to Texas now. We had the U.S. Supreme Court say, Texas, you can't enforce that thing for now. Why did they do that?
It's hard to know why the five-justice majority did that. They didn't provide any explanation. So we really don't know. All that we have is the word of three justices in dissent, and really that's the only information that we have.
What did the dissenters say?
Well, they basically said, the first thing they said is this is an incredibly important question that will come before the court. So that's certainly a signal that at least three justices believe that this is an issue that belongs before the court. But they basically said that for various reasons they would have. So basically, the Fifth Circuit, the intermediate federal court, had put the law, had allowed the law to go into effect. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, we feel like we shouldn't be stepping in here. This is not the kind of situation where we need to step in. We should have just let the lower courts do what they're doing. And we will hear the case when it eventually comes to us in the normal way. We'll do a full appeal if we take the case. But for right now, we shouldn't get involved. And the majority disagreed. And the majority said, nope, we're going to get involved and we're going to put this law on hold. They didn't say why, but they took that very important step here. And we think it was a really key step for free speech.
So what is next in the process from now until it gets back to the Supreme Court?
Basically, this case out of Texas, it's now back before the Fifth Circuit, the intermediate court. And the Fifth Circuit will, at some point in the next weeks or months, issue an actual decision on the merits, telling us what they think about this law, whether it's unconstitutional, constitutional, parts of it maybe constitutional or not. And then it's very likely that either side or both sides will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the court may very well take that case because it is so important. There is another case out of Florida that's currently in another court of appeals. That case will also likely be appealed to the Supreme Court. So they'll have more than one chance to take up this general issue.
Now, something that's weird. This is Texas issuing a law here. There's no such thing as Texas Twitter. It's interstate, international. What happens when a state tries to regulate something that clearly flows through its borders, but also beyond its borders?
Well, it's really hard to know here, partly because, obviously this is the internet, as everyone knows. It doesn't end at state borders, nor do these companies' operations. And, we really don't know what the companies' options are because we don't really, see under the hood and know what all the operations are. So it's just hard to know For example, here, these two laws have been passed, one in Texas, one in Florida. They're different. They have some similarities, but they're different. So if you're Facebook or Twitter, how would you comply with both of them at the same time? I think that would be certainly a challenge for these companies, but we feel strongly that the key provisions of the Texas law and also the Florida law are unconstitutional. And so we hope that the social media companies will not have to have to deal with these the key parts of these statutes, which prevent them from taking down content they want to take down.
If they do end up getting approved by the U.S. Supreme Court, what could that end up meaning for, say, Twitter or Facebook and their ability to limit content, not just, you know, political content or whatever, but stuff that I think a lot of people would agree they don't want to see on their social media feeds?
Well, that's certainly one of the things they've been saying, and we think it's generally right that the Texas law, for example, as I said earlier, if it went into effect, it would require them to publish a lot of content that I don't think anybody really wants to see. I mean, we're talking about glorifications of violence, suicide, pornography, hate speech, all kinds of things that the platforms currently try to take down. They may not succeed all the time. They may make mistakes, but these are things that I don't think anybody wants to see. And I think the platforms would be prevented from taking those steps.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob. It's been great being here.
Scott Wilkins, a senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. He was with us today to talk about the First Amendment and the internet and social media. That's after the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a Texas law from going into effect this week. That law would have prevented social media companies from being able to moderate a lot of content on their platforms. For almost 60 years, Racine's Rotary Club has been throwing a massive post-prom party. It's a place where students can show off their outfits before partying in an alcohol-free environment after their school dances. And this year, after 2 years of rescheduled, virtual, or masked celebrations, the event felt a little more special. Madeline Fox takes us to prom night.
Family members started gathering in the bleachers at the Racine County Fairgrounds an hour before students from 9 high schools started arriving. Their seats faced a track where students drove by in their motorcade and, past that, a red carpet. The motorcade and red carpet are part of an annual Racine tradition that goes back to 1953. It brings together students from area public and private schools and their cheering families and community members watching it live on public access TV for an after prom party. This year, it was a taste of joy and normality after 3 years when that's been harder to come by.
Our freshman year is probably the only normal year we've had. So, I mean, having our senior year be normal is pretty nice.
That's Alina Gomez, prom queen at Union Grove High School. Alina's mom went to post-prom when she was in high school, too.
My mom showed me her old prom videos, like on the, what is it, the VHS tapes or whatever they're called.
This year's red carpet had a spot just past a rose-covered archway where students could stop to get their pictures taken. Many had dates, but others came in groups of friends, like Union Grove senior Emily Patterson, who looked everywhere for her dream dress.
We had to go to a lot of different places, but I ended up getting my dress from Windsor. I always end up getting my dresses from Windsor, but I very much wanted a purple dress, so that's where I found mine.
Her friend Grace Moore wore red with elbow-length black gloves.
I also got my dress from Windsor, but it was the last one on the rack, so I had to squeeze into it no matter what, and it was like, I was so lucky I found it because there was nothing else.
And Maddie Good, another friend, went online for her black jumpsuit.
I got mine from good old Amazon, Mr. Jeffrey Bezos.
Jeffrey Bezos.
Coming in clutch.
The dresses were a hit with spectators, too. Sandra Evans and her nieces came to watch Sandra's daughter, Janessa, a senior at Case, walk the red carpet.
I think that's great to see all the dresses, you know, and that's very, very pretty.
My favorite dress is Janessa's.
Janessa's?
What is she wearing?
She's wearing
a red dress.
And it has, like, gems on it.
The biggest entrance of the night came from Bennett Wilkes and his date Liliana Kading, who rode in on one of the Wilkes family's tractors while onlookers cheered and crowded to the fence to take photos.
Our family farms, like, 2 miles from here, so that was one of our tractors. My dad was actually the one that gave me the idea last year when my brother had prom here, so, yeah.
The 2020 post-prom was virtual. Last year's was back in person, but students had to wear their masks everywhere but the red carpet. For some parents, this year's post-prom offered a second chance to celebrate their kids. Vivian Augustus was cheering her daughter Asia on from the sidelines. One of her sons was a senior in 2020.
They didn't have one, and that was my son's prom, so they didn't have one, so this is like my first time down here. She's my last one. I had two boys, and she's my baby. So this is my last one, so I don't know what I'm going to do with myself now.
The students were having fun. They were catching up with friends, taking photos for Instagram, and dancing to hits, mostly from the early 2010s. Two girls karaoke'd to Carrie Underwood's Before He Cheats. But the students could also see they were lucky to get to celebrate together. St. Catherine senior Nevaeh Innocencio Martinez came with her date, Elijah Matthews, in matching iridescent white outfits.
Everybody looking healthy and everybody's able to enjoy this moment together after, you know, the pandemic and stuff. Because, you know, there was one year when a class didn't have a, you know, prom. And we're grateful that we did.
This year's graduating seniors can claim three of the weirdest, most unprecedented high school years in recent memory. They're going on to jobs and college knowing that it's probably not over yet, and it's even harder than usual to predict what those next years will hold. But they're also finding joy when they can. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, Congress is considering gun legislation after the latest wave of mass shootings, and President Biden made the case for some of those changes in a speech yesterday, but it's still a tall order with Republican arguments against those measures. We'll find out what's on the table and what could pass, and as always, you can weigh in with your thoughts on the ideas on the table. Plus, we'll meet the creator of a Milwaukee web program that's encouraging kids to read, and we'll get some great summertime reading suggestions along the way. If you have a favorite kids book you want to share with us, email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us to talk about the latest election news, including former President Trump's endorsement of a Republican candidate for governor. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, a cookbook author talks to us about heritage grains and flours and why they can be a better choice for the environment and for our cooking. Now, there's a lot of election-related news here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Elections Commissioner Dean Knutson resigned from the board. Knutson, a Republican appointee, said that officials, quote, from the highest levels of the Republican Party, end quote, did not want him to lead the bipartisan group because he doesn't deny the results of the 2020 election. And former President Donald Trump endorsed Wisconsin Republican candidate Tim Michaels in his primary campaign for governor. We're checking out the latest election news in Wisconsin, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have your eye on this elections commission story? Do you have a question about what it means, how it works? Waiting on an appointee to that could come down even during the show. Potentially, what are you hoping for or worried about? And in the race for governor, does former President Trump's endorsement matter to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob.
Let's start with Dean Knutson, now resigning from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, saying it's because fellow Republicans criticized him for not saying the 2020 election was fraudulent. Here's a listen.
In this case, the painful truth is that President Trump lost the election in 2020, lost the election in Wisconsin in 2020. And the loss was not due to election fraud.
Sean, what do we know about what pushed Knutson to step down from the commission?
So I think it's significant that he made this announcement. He stepped down from the commission right before the commission was about to select a new chair. And this is a commission that is split 3-3 between Republicans and Democrats. And the state law that set it up, the commission chair position has to shift back and forth every 2 years from Republicans to Democrats. So the current chair is a Democrat. That meant the next chair was going to be a Republican. It can't be one of a couple clerks on the committee. So that meant it was either going to be Knutson or Bob Spindell, an outspoken critic of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, who was openly campaigning to be chair of the agency. So you had this situation where, because you got to get four votes to be elected chair, there was a chance that Knutson was going to get elected chair, even though he wasn't running for it, even though Spindell wanted it. And Knutson says Republicans leaned on him to get out of that race. They didn't want him to be chair. Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, actually kind of laid claim to that, put out a statement and said that he had talked to Speaker Voss. Speaker Voss appointed Knutson to this commission and told Voss that Knutson no longer had the support of the grassroots Republicans in Wisconsin.
Why does this position of committee chair matter?
I don't know that the position of committee chair matters as much as like the chair of the legislature's budget committee, for example. It doesn't have that kind of power. I mean, they can force some procedural votes or steer debates procedurally at times to their advantage. But it's not like they exactly hold a lot of additional power over the other commissioners. They kind of have the bully pulpit. They can speak for the commission in a way that the others can't at times. But, you know, that also is debatable. I think right now, really, because there's only six people who serve on this elections commission, and everything involving elections is under such a spotlight right now, and seems like it will continue to be in Wisconsin. Every person who serves on this panel, is a big deal. And so now that you have an opening, it's a kind of a big question as to who's going to fill it.
Right. So the next chair is either going to be a Bob Spindell or TBD. Let's look at each of those in turn. Bob Spindell got a lot of controversy because he signed a thing saying he was an elector from Wisconsin after the 2020 election. The case was made by a lot of those electors or self-proclaimed electors that, well, this was just if courts overturned the outcome of the election, gave it over to Trump, then they would step in. Some of the people who did that in other states specifically included language saying, we're just doing this in case it flips. That didn't happen in Wisconsin. That's gotten a lot of criticism, some efforts in courts, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lawsuit brought against Spindell and the other Republicans who posed as electors in Wisconsin and like saying that they violated a variety of state and federal laws. This is something that Democrats have asked about as part of this January 6th commission at the U.S. Capitol. And, you know, Spindell was one of those 10 people who the Republicans who met at the same time as Wisconsin's actual electors signed documents, official looking documents, sent them to, you know, the National Archives, the president of the U.S. Senate, the Secretary of State, the chief judge for the Western District of Wisconsin, all the places where actual electors' certificates are to be sent. They sent the GOP electors sent them there too, and without any kind of legal force. So that has given Spindell a special, I guess, distinction on this commission. But I think beyond that, if you've listened to any commission meeting, you know that he is certainly an outspoken critic of the agency at times. And I would say Knutson was too, has been also, but not in the same way as Spindell.
So that's Bob Spindell. Then there's TBD. What do we know about who's going to get appointed? It's Speaker Voss, as you mentioned, who makes this appointment. What do we know about who and when? And when could literally be 2 minutes ago. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, TBD has a pretty good chance of being chair of the commission, really, just because whoever gets in there is going to need one Democrat to vote for them along with the Republicans, at least. And so, you know, I think Spindell just has kind of, he faces headwinds on that committee, we'll say, in order to win Democratic support. We don't know who Speaker Voss would pick. The way that the commission is, you know, divvied up, you have one commissioner each is appointed by the Assembly Speaker, the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Minority Leader, and the Assembly Minority Leader. So Dean Knutson was Robin Voss's pick for the commission, so he gets to pick a new person now. He has said that he's keeping all of his options open. You know, he hasn't ruled anybody out. He said he kind of liked to have an attorney on there because, you know, Democrats have attorneys on that commission. And, you know, when you come down to some of the issues that come before the board, that it seems like the attorneys are sometimes making arguments, trying to win support of like one of the clerks that's on the panel. So that's somebody the Voss has said that he'd like to have, is like a hard charging conservative, I think is the way that he phrased it, and an attorney. You might also, I think, potentially look at some of these Republican lawmakers who served under Voss in the Assembly. You know, they may be somebody who's available to serve on a commission like this, but we don't have any names yet.
Talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about big election news in the state. That's the Wisconsin Elections Commission. And now we have a Republican primary in the race for governor, people looking to challenge Governor Tony Evers this November. Much anticipated, I think, endorsement from former President Trump. What did he say?
He said that Tim Michaels is his candidate for governor in this Republican primary. And, you know, and anything that he says after that almost doesn't matter. He has given his name, the Trump name, to Tim Michaels to use in this primary where he's facing other candidates who also wanted the Trump endorsement. You know, Rebecca Clayfish, the former lieutenant governor, and the person supported by the Scott Walker machine, including Scott Walker in this campaign. Tim Rampton, a state lawmaker who has been a very outspoken supporter of Donald Trump, even called for the legislature to try to revoke the 2020 election results, you know, on behalf of Trump. Has really stuck his neck out there for the former president. He didn't get the endorsement. Clayfish didn't get the endorsement. Michaels did. And that has been a game changer in some Republican primaries where Trump's backing has helped a Republican emerge from a crowded field. Didn't happen in Georgia, which we heard about in the news recently, where Trump's pick got beaten badly by the incumbent candidate there. But in other races where you don't have an incumbent and it's more of a wide open field, that endorsement has been big, and it could be big for Tim Michaels, who also has shown a willingness to spend his own money in that race and can really amplify the Trump endorsement that way.
Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief with us to talk about the latest election news here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As you watch this Republican field in the race for governor, does former President Trump's endorsement matter to you? Do you think, if you're going to play political analyst for a moment, do you think it's going to matter to Republican voters in the state? If you're watching either of these contested primaries for governor or for U.S. Senate, do you have strong feelings about one candidate or another, or are you going to vote for or against them no matter what? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How about the Wisconsin Elections Commission? What do you want to see come out of this new appointment? Do you support getting rid of it, as the Republican candidates for governor do? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the latest election news here in Wisconsin, including the resignation of Wisconsin Elections Commissioner Dean Knutson and what's going to come next, and former President Trump's endorsement of a Republican candidate for governor, Tim Michaels. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What are you watching for in this election? What are you wanting to hear from candidates in those primary fields for governor, Republicans, or Senate, Democrats? 800-642-1234 is the number. Tom joins us now in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I grew up in Chicago, and I describe a lot of Wisconsin politics as gerrymandering that would make the Daily Machine Democrat blush. I've never seen anything like it. But I think the thing that offends me more than just straight politics is Ron Johnson's disinformation when it comes to COVID. I think creating fear where there is really no fear. It's based on nothing. When you actually get taken off YouTube because your claims are so false, this is playing around with people's lives and infection rates. And to me, this is beyond the pale and beyond politics. I hope he's defeated soundly.
Thanks a lot for the call. A couple points there, Sean. You've, of course, followed gerrymandering quite closely with the Mapped Out podcast. New edition dropped just this week. Tom compares Illinois, a pretty heavily gerrymandered state by Democrats, to Wisconsin. Where does Wisconsin stand on the map of gerrymandered maps?
I think the distinction in Wisconsin is that, you know, we are a more of a 50-50 state in terms of our electorate. And so when you have a big Republican margin here, it ends up being, you know, in terms of like the partisan representation of the state, it is more askew, I guess, compared to Illinois, where you do have a Democratic edge in that state, but they have kind of parlayed that into a huge Democratic edge, especially in their congressional map.
And then Senator Johnson, we haven't talked about the race for Senate there. We've got a bunch of Democratic candidates lining up in the primary. Ron Johnson, of course, the incumbent running for a third term. Polling, at least, has shown some pretty big negatives for Senator Johnson. That said, he's overcome some tough polls in his previous elections.
Yeah, I think Senator Johnson in this cycle, from what we can tell, based on the polling from Marquette University, has higher negatives than he's ever had before. More people know him this time around than have known him before, but you have both positive and negative opinions of him, and then those negatives, those people who disapprove of his time in office, are climbing. I think it is kind of maybe an open question at this point as to which race, the race for governor or the race for U.S. Senate, will be the marquee race in Wisconsin. You know, I think that probably you would say conventional wisdom say the U.S. Senate race, once there's a Democrat chosen in that primary and they're facing off against Johnson, there's 100 U.S. senators and they obviously holding, you know, extreme power in this country. But we just have two really huge elections here in a statewide level in Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Bob now in Milwaukee. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Thanks for taking. Well, basically, I was going to bring up as far as I voted for Evers last time, but I'm not really impressed with his pretty much anything he's done so far as far as being a leader. But you guys brought up Ron Johnson, and I didn't know that we were talking about Ron Johnson. But Ron Johnson, I'm a doctor, and he really hasn't brought up anything on COVID that isn't being talked about by other doctors. And so I really feel like the CDC has basically promoted more fear than anybody else.
So do you have a candidate you like on the Republican side to challenge Evers?
Well, yeah, I was going to say about whether Trump's endorsement matters or not. I basically am looking at, you know, all sides. I consider myself an independent, but it basically is like Trump's endorsement doesn't really mean one thing or the other, but I'm sure to some people it would.
Gotcha. Bob, thanks a lot. And Sean, that's going to be a big question here. How much people, especially people who are going to vote in a Republican primary, are going to focus on an endorsement from the former president?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be like the thing that totally tips the race. I think you'd be hard pressed to find an endorsement in Republican politics that matters more than Trump's in 2022. I mean, there's a reason these candidates made trips down to Florida to try to win that endorsement. You know, it's because it could be a game changer in their race. You could imagine that if Rebecca Clayfish, who already has kind of this grassroots support around the state from having built this campaign or the foundation for this campaign for governor for years, has the support of people like Scott Walker, for example. If she had won the Trump endorsement, I think it would have been very hard for one of the other candidates to say, you know, I can take down Rebecca Clayfish. I think by Tim Michaels winning, that coupled with his personal wealth and his willing to spend it, seems like at the very least it opens a door for him to challenge Clayfish. And, you know, there are definitely people out there who would go much farther than that in terms of how they would describe the endorsement. Anthony Trugowski, who I talked to for a story on this endorsement last night, UW La Crosse political science professor, he says it makes Michaels the front runner, and he doesn't really see it halfway. You know, he says, like, if you just look at the timing of this, it's June. People are just now starting to pay attention to the primary for governor. It gives Michaels a chance to really drive this endorsement home. But, you know, we'll see. Rebecca Clayfish has a lot of people backing her.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, about the latest Wisconsin election-related news. Back to your calls. Nate is with us in Westfield. Nate, hi.
Thanks for taking the call, guys. I'm just going to chime in a little bit on this issue of Clayfish. I'm really a Democrat, but we saw what Bernie Sanders' followers, how they felt. And once somebody... like I'm talking about the ladies here, once they glom on to a woman having a chance and then she's being bypassed, and then you got the confounding factor of what's going on with abortion, I'm not sure that you can simply endorse Michaels as being the front runner.
Nate, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Sean, Nate thinking there could be, I guess, bad blood among Republicans, especially Clayfish supporters.
Yeah, and you might see this race become more negative here because Michaels may think that even though he has Trump's endorsement at this point, he may feel like he needs to go negative at some point in order to, surpass Clayfish. She may feel threatened by the Trump endorsement or, the Michaels approach and may go negative on him. Kevin Nicholson, who is running for governor, has also painted himself as this outsider candidate and has definitely already gone negative against Clayfish and Michaels. And so you've got that factor in the race. I haven't heard Tim Ramthen, the state representative from Campbellsport, go negative on other Republicans in the same way. But he's kind of a factor in the race because of the way that he's talked about the 2020 election. But yeah, the temperature of the primary could get turned up here if the candidates feel like they need to attack each other instead of Evers in order to win the GOP nomination in August.
Thanks for the call, Nate. Renee joins us now in Milwaukee. Renee, hi.
Hi, I'm a registered Republican, but I'm thoroughly disgusted by Republicans, and I want to vote in the primary and maybe throw a monkey wrench in there. So who is the least probable primary Republican candidate that I should vote for?
Renee, thanks for the call. Sean, I think sometimes politicians try to play that, like, can we get the weakest opponent? It seems like a tough game to play, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to, like, people talk about election conspiracies, but something like that is pretty tough to pull off, to have, voters around the state all think the same way and, you know, choose a candidate that would be easiest for the Democrat to beat in the general election in this, for instance. So I'm not going to speculate on that one.
Thanks for the call. I should ask, I heard a rumor you were interviewing Tim Michaels today, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, I had a few minutes to talk to Tim Michaels about the endorsement and just ask him about whether there were kind of any strings attached to this endorsement. He said that he made no promises to President Trump. However, he does kind of echo what you hear from Trump in terms of the way that the 2020 election has been portrayed. I had a chance to ask him if he thought that President Joe Biden had won Wisconsin, and Tim Michaels declined to say yes. I think also notably, Tim Michaels, if he were elected, he would be governor in 2024 when Wisconsin's governor is asked to certify the next presidential election. And, you know, Michaels wouldn't say definitively that he would do that. You know, he said he's kind of a know it when I see it kind of guy, I believe was the way he put it. And he would look at the situation and make a decision then about how he would deal with it.
Sean, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. He talked to us today about the latest election news here in Wisconsin. Follow his reporting and our great team of reporters in general over at WPR.org. Coming up on Food Friday, heritage grains and how to use them. A cookbook author tells us about everything from oats to einkorn and barley and how to use them all in our cooking. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.